After experiencing the transformative power of a regular meditation practice, it's natural to feel inspired to share this gift and guide others on their own journey of discovery through meditation. Join Buddhist teacher David Nichtern and Duncan Trussell, comedian and creator of the Netflix animated series The Midnight Gospel, for a free online event on Tuesday, May 7th at 6 p.m. Eastern Time. They'll discuss the profound practices of mindfulness in Dharma Moon's renowned mindfulness meditation teacher training program. Get certified by Dharma Moon to teach meditation, lead group practice sessions, and work with individual students. Visit dharmamoon.com/beherenow for more info and to reserve your spot for the free online event with David Nichtern and Duncan Trussell.
As Einstein says, you cannot solve the problem at the level of the problem. This capacity to heal and to whole and to forgive is incredibly important. And I think that that's the energy that gives us this as a tool to use for restorative justice, to restoring and uplifting the good in all of us. Mm-hmm.
Welcome to the Metta Hour with Sharon Salzberg, where Buddhist wisdom meets everyday life. This podcast is brought to you by the Be Here Now Network and features interviews with the top leaders, teachers, and thinkers of the mindfulness movement and beyond. For more information, visit BeHereNowNetwork.com/Sharon.
Hi, this is Sharon Salzberg, and today I'm in conversation with Cecilia Loving. Cecilia is an award-winning speaker, diversity, equity, accessibility, and inclusion thought leader, consultant, and author. Her work focuses on restorative justice, storytelling, inclusive leadership, racial inclusion, mindfulness, and well-being. She is a senior vice president of diversity, equity, and inclusion at PBS, with over 25 years of experience in DEI. Before joining PBS, Cecilia served as the New York Fire Department's Deputy Commissioner, Chief Diversity and Inclusion Officer, and recently chaired the New York City Bar Association's first Committee on Mindfulness and Well-being. Cecilia has practiced meditation since she was a teen in Detroit, and is the author of several books, including The Power of Inclusion and Unbroken Circles, Holding Space, Finding Forgiveness, and Transcending Edges. Welcome to you, Cecilia. It's such a pleasure to have you here on the Metta Hour.
Thanks so much. I'm really grateful to be here.
When I think of you, and I do think of you often with a smile, one of the first things I think of is that you're a very big practitioner of loving kindness meditation. So tell me more about how you first found meditation and what your path has been with it.
Well, one of the things you mentioned is that I have been practicing meditation since I was a teen, and that was in the early 70s, living in the inner city of Detroit. And oftentimes I sought refuge from my surroundings in books and poetry, and often borrow my mother's books. And so I confiscated one of her books that was called Mind a Master Power by Reverend Charles Roth. And that's a book of practical meditations and advice. And he introduced to me for the first time this concept of God as the kingdom within us, what some call the indwelling Christ. And I believe that it was that study of Mind the Master Power that really was a shift that changed the way I viewed the world. And so it was this time period, I should mention, was also shortly after the Detroit riots and the assassination, mm-hmm. we know, of the Kennedys and Martin Luther King Jr. And so I was trying at the time also to make sense out of this concept of a nonviolent, beloved community at a time when violence appeared to be part of the energy of change. And so my mother had studied sewing with Rosa Parks. I always say she didn't learn how to sew, but she learned a lot about the civil rights movement and supplemented our public education with Black history. And at the same time, enrolled us in a course for youth at a place in Detroit called the Home of Love. And it was led by a popular DJ there, the late Martha Jean, the Queen, that was her radio handle. And she was a great influencer and supporter of blue collar workers. But unbeknownst to many, she was also an advocate of the power of love and its healing power. And she taught us some things that are still the foundation of my practice. She taught us how to pray. She taught us how to use the power of affirmations. And she taught us how to meditate. And so that was my foundation for years. A few years after that, I moved to Washington, D.C. to attend Howard University. And I would go to this bookstore in Georgetown called the Yes Bookstore, which was a metaphysical bookstore. And that's what I used to continue to expand my research on meditation, reading books like The Silence as Yoga. That really teaches how we lift our hearts beyond the limited conceptions of life so that we can breathe freely in the infinite expanse of spirit. And so I'll pause for there. Right there, I was studying things like the Prophet, where Gibran teaches us that not only is God in our hearts, but really we are in the heart of God. And so that's sort of the journey that I was on, which is different than a number of people because it didn't begin in the Bible, what I call the ancient texts, but it took me there and it gave me a different perception, I think, of God as love, and that we should focus not merely on teachings about Jesus, but really examine what Jesus taught. And so, you know, for example, one of the things that I tend to meditate on a lot is a scripture from John 14, 20, where he says, "I am in my Father, and you are in me, and I am in you." And I can meditate on that alone for years.
That's beautiful. In some funny way, it reminds me of this comment one of my early teachers made to me. And this is, of course, in a very different context, in a Buddhist context in India. Whereas this teacher, a man named Manindra, he looked at me and he said, "The Buddha's enlightenment solved the Buddha's problem. Now you solve yours." And it made it so clear it wasn't a question only of respecting the attainment of someone else, but embodying it, you know, becoming it. And it also felt, honestly, for me, the first time in my life, maybe somebody was looking at me as though to say, "You can solve your problem. You can solve your problem, you know, the loneliness, the unhappiness, the fragmentation that's brought you here to India to begin with. You can do this." And that is very different than how most people perhaps have been conditioned to approach spirituality or religion, you know, which is really more about the attainment of another and the admiration of that rather than what about me, you know?
Which also reminds me of Eric Butterworth, who was one of the teachers who I studied under in the 80s and the 90s when I was living in New York, and in one of his books, Life is for Loving, he mentions that within every person there is a hunger and a thirst to be love, to express love, and to let the infinite power of love flow through them.
And I want to mention your book here as well, The Power of Inclusion, Meditating with Compassion, Healing with Generosity, Leading with Love. How did that book come about?
So thank you for that question. And one of the things that I wanted to do when I knew I was going to probably be leaving FDNY, and I wanted to sum up some of the things that I had learned in what I call the DEI, the diversity, equity, and inclusion space. And so I was sort of spirit-led to write a book to summarize everything and to also lift up the importance of love, of spirit, of faith in this newly emerging field that focuses a lot on the intellect, that focuses on the business case, in order to convince people that DEI is important. And so it looks at the profitability of organizations, mm-hmm. as opposed to looking at its importance in our evolution as a people and how it helps our own well-being. And so mm-hmm. to me, inclusion really is the energy of love. And in the book, one of the things that I mentioned is that without love, inclusion does not exist. And love embraces everyone as an extension of one family, realizing mm-hmm. that when one suffers, we all suffer. So it's my testimonial of the importance of DEI and how we can bring our whole selves to it, and also how we can use it as a catalyst to shape a holistic approach in leading DEI at organizations.
Well, I think that's really tremendous because, you know, I read a lot these days about resilience, you know, of all kinds of systems, of cities, of waterways, of people, of leadership, you know, all kinds of things. And something that seems to be growing in popularity and understanding is looking at the natural world for what allows, say, a forest to be resilient after there's been a fire. You know, what allows something to come back and not just come back in a kind of static way, you know, to where we were stuck before, but in an ongoing way, in a generative way, so that we're back, but we're growing and we're changing and we're adapting. And one of the things they always talk about in terms of the forest is diversity. You know, if only one type of thing had been growing in that particular stretch of forest, it's going to be much, much harder to find the conditions for flourishing. To return, to renew. And they talk about decentralized leadership, so to speak. You know, if you're counting on, well, because there's apparently quite a bit of communication in the forest, like who knew, you know? I grew up in New York City too. You know, but the nature of things truly is there's a lot of communication, warning of danger, reminding where nourishment can be found and so on. And that needs to be decentralized. If it's held in one corner, you're going to be much harder, you know, to find the resources to begin again and to start again. And it's so clear from the natural world that this is a picture of what will just make it a lot easier to not only survive, but flourish as we all face change all the time.
Yes. And you're also reminding me and lifting up the importance of that, of also the importance in general of our indigenous teachers mm-hmm. and the work that is also reflected in my book, but one that I have really valued a lot is the importance of all our relations and our ancestors, not merely being the people that we know and relate to because we've heard about them in terms of our family history, but the plants and the animals and our connection with all of life. And we've talked in the past about also circles and the energy around healing circles and the importance of honoring all voices and holding the talking piece, which is an indigenous practice that has informed a lot of the work that I do in DEI. And I really not only honor the practice, but as my colleague Gina Liao and I always say, and she's someone who worked with me at FDNY and is a great circle keeper, we call circles the gift that keeps giving.
Do you want to describe circles a little bit for us?
Sure. Circles are, you can do them virtually or you can do them in person, of course, but it is that ancient tradition that comes from sitting, elders sitting around the fire, or just community connecting. And there is a talking piece, and the only person who can speak is the person holding the talking piece. And that piece is passed in one direction. And it allows all voices to be heard. It is particularly important when it comes to deep listening and in sharing our stories and establishing that common ground upon stories that we all can relate to. But most importantly, it opens us up to see and to honor and to also be heard in a very different way. And so at FDNY, I started using this practice of circles, which are used a lot in restorative justice, but also using them in a different way to build community, to develop emotional intelligence, and sometimes even to resolve conflict. So, you know, just to give you an example, we would hold courageous conversations, which we do also at PBS, around issues that are important but very difficult to talk about. We also would hold monthly circles that we call Bravest Women Talk, so that we can allow all of those voices that might be unheard to be heard. And at PBS, the circles are considered one of the most honored now and most radical ways that are changing and shifting and opening up new space and new energy to see each other in a different way, to hear and to also heal.
And you have another book, Unbroken Circles, called Holding Space, Finding Forgiveness, Transcending Edges, which is all about that, right?
Yes. Yeah, so the Unbroken Circles book I created after I was spending a great deal of time in circle and oftentimes would create poetry and openings and closings for a circle. And so that book really provides the additional poetry and insights and openings that can be used by others in circle. The Power of Inclusion actually talks more about the process of circle and its importance in the DEI space.
Mm-hmm. It was very interesting, you know, as we started talking, just chatting, as we're doing, you know, tech check and sound check and things like that. I had just been through a process that my own retreat center that involved a circle. And I think I'd forgotten somehow in the course of being busy, you know, like and having a life, I'd forgotten just the power of feeling heard. Because it's not an elaborate process, really. It's very simple. And I think it takes some deep thinking to sort of feel like what's so powerful about it. You know, why does it seem to have such an effect? And it was just very interesting because it's, I know as a teacher, and I think a teacher of anything goes through this where you think what I'm offering is like a little too simplistic or something, you know, it needs to be fancier or you know, how are the people going to have confidence in it unless it's more elaborate and it's got more flourishes and things like that. And But I think about the best teachers I've had that I would feel were the best teachers, and they were very simple, actually, and often repetitive, strangely enough. And then I think about the process we just went through, and I think, well, maybe one very powerful thing is just like you got to say what you were feeling, and nobody was like jumping on you and suggesting that you feel a different way.
It is so simple when, you know, the circle keepers put the questions or prompts into the circle. And one of the, to me, most engaging prompts is simply, what do you need to say to be present? Or is there anything else that you need to put into the circle? And if you have those two prompts, basically you're equipped to lead a circle. And I've been in circles where we've had a number of rounds simply around, what do you need to say next? Mm-hmm. And just the way that you engage and open up and speak from the heart is so compelling. And I have led leaders in circle where just some very simple, basic prompts resulted in tears and shifts and vulnerability around what needed to be said and what needed to be heard, and just the opportunity to build community by building a safe container to share what was on their minds. One of the other types of circles that I've done is actually in silence. And it is like having, and I have in my office at PBS, a basket of sticks. And I learned from Elizabeth Clemens, who also studied with Kay Prannis, both of whom are amazing circle keepers, the importance of using those sticks. And so what you do in the silence, and you have to do this physically, of course, is you pass the talking stick, you walk into the center of the circle, and you place the sticks in just amazing ways, whatever comes up for you, and then you pass it to someone else. And at FDNY, some of the firefighters who I've been in circle with just did the most amazing displays of sticks. Mm-hmm. And it's something that is so simple, but really builds community.
Wow, that's incredible. I wanted to ask you about a different kind of circle. I'm taking this one in for a moment, which is around restorative justice, because it's such a fascinating movement in criminal justice reform. And speaks to, I think, how difficult it is for any of us as human beings to understand that our actions have consequences and to feel those consequences, and how important that is in coming to terms with guilt and remorse and moving on and or staying with but what's happened. And it seems like a particularly potent place to have the process. So I'm wondering if you could say something about restorative justice.
Sure. I believe that this evolving process, as I mentioned, of humanity and the power of love and compassion is so incredibly important, no matter what the field. And as you indicate, what takes us to one of the greatest tests is in our criminal justice system. And of course, some of the most powerful testimonials of Circle are with restorative justice. And people who have been the victim of horrendous crimes, have had spouses killed, ended up being able to resolve them with the power of this healing process. And so as many of my fellow circle keepers say, there is power in the circle. Or if there are issues that flare up, they say, let's just put it in the circle. And so there is something about the process and its accountability and the oneness, I believe, that we all share, and just being able to hold space to establish that common ground, to come to terms with the fact that not only are we have many of us or all of us rather been harmed, but we have also harmed others. Mm-hmm. And it is that process of having the capacity to love and to transcend whatever it is that we are feeling from an emotional aspect, to lift ourselves up above the fray. As Einstein says, you cannot solve the problem at the level of the problem. This capacity to heal and to whole and to forgive is incredibly important. And I think that that's the energy that gives us this as a tool to use for restorative justice. Having been a lawyer and also at one point way back in my career, a criminal attorney, you realize that, you know, it's a lose-lose situation ultimately when the focus is on punishing as opposed to restoring and uplifting the good in all of us.
Mm-hmm. Well, I can remember, you know, somebody was trying to give me examples once years ago, and they had established this particular friend who since died tragically, but was at the time she was an attorney. She had been a police officer for like 20 years or something like that. And she was establishing some different novel kind of analyses of criminal justice. So, for example, there was a youth court. And so if a young person committed an infraction that was not, you know, horribly serious, not really severe, but was, you know, something that was not good, they would be sentenced by a community of their peers, you know, and maybe they'd be sentenced to music class or something like that, something that you wouldn't really think of in a court of law. And it was so interesting. And one of the things she was trying to explain to me was like, if you had robbed a store, maybe your thought was, does it matter? The guy has a lot of money, you know, he misses payroll for 1 week and it makes no difference. But then if you actually hear his story, maybe it did make a difference. Maybe his sister couldn't pay rent because he's been paying her rent and suddenly had no money for a week. And because she couldn't pay rent, there were these consequences for her as a single mother. And then there was, you know, and it's like, we don't get it. You know, the circles with which we are interacting, we are connected and that actions are consequential. And it made a big difference to the kind of the maturity and the development of these people to say, oh, it did make a difference. You know, what I do makes a difference.
Yes, it's so important when you look at the creativity that we need in everything, and particularly in the criminal justice system. When I was in New York, I had the opportunity to actually sit on the bench with jurors who were in some of the community courts. In a variety, whether they were dealing with drugs or dealing with prostitution that usually came up in the court that's in the theater district, or they were dealing with some kind of marital dispute, the ability for the judge to exercise something that was non-traditional but helped really address healing the harm in a different way was so incredibly important. And circles, of course, are one of the most phenomenal ways that you do that, and particularly you being used in the schools as well. And I just want to lift up that there are also restorative cities. Oakland is one. Detroit is one. And as I was preparing to leave New York, I was grateful that it appeared at the time that New York City was becoming one. And my team and I were able to lead circles for the mayor's office, for our colleagues at some of the other city agencies, and also for some of the private law firms and other places that wanted to engage in healing in a new way. So I'm really grateful for you lifting up the power of restorative justice and how it shows up in a number of ways.
So the pandemic itself has been a time of many reveals. We've sort of had the curtain pulled back on a lot of hidden aspects, or more hidden aspects, of our culture and the assumptions we live by. At the same time, there's a lot of pushback against growth in the U.S. And I'm wondering how you're seeing this effect in your work in DEI. Is there more of an opening to discuss things like systemic racism that wasn't there before COVID?
Oh, most definitely. I think that there was work that we did in DEI that was can also almost be divided before and after George Floyd's death, in that that was really the dividing point when there was a lot more accountability, there was a lot more now focus and commitment to DEI. I think that there's still a lot of fear, mm-hmm. but more of a willingness to push past that fear to address the needs that can no longer be ignored. For example, when I was at the fire department, I would say after after George Floyd's death, there was more of a commitment by the city in general to address the needs that were always there. And I was on the mayor's task force. I established a task force on racial inclusion at the fire department. And there was a more willingness to dig deep and do a root cause analysis mm-hmm. around how did we get to this, you know, why do we have these particular problems? And then most importantly, I believe a lot of leaders realize that DEI has to really report to the top so that there won't be interference, and that one individual or office cannot be held accountable for everything that needs to be done in the DEI space, but that it is the commitment of an entire organization. Mm-hmm. So all of these things, I believe, have been impacted by George Floyd. And I love what his daughter said, just a little girl who said, "My daddy changed the world." Mm-hmm. And I think in many, many respects, his death most definitely did have a huge impact on our commitment to inclusion.
So through your work with the fire department, I imagine you were working with police officers at the same time?
I did. And I also did some training for NYPD as well. And interestingly enough, a lot of firefighters are former police officers. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And, you know, some of the training that I did for NYPD was in emotional intelligence. One of the last, I did 4 sessions on emotional intelligence when just before COVID, before we were more sequestered and stopped working physically mm-hmm. with some of the groups. And the interesting thing is I had officers come up to me, literally some were almost bursting into tears mm-hmm. and said, "This is just what I needed." Mm-hmm. At FDNY, we were also, I believe, able to do more in the mindfulness space than I experienced at NYPD, although I'm sure that's going to shift with the current mayor, who is Eric Adams, is very much committed to to mindfulness. And so at the fire department, we were, you know, I was able to create the first mindfulness group, mindfulness newsletter. And as first responders, they use a lot of the practices in order to deal with stress. And so they're using breathing techniques and affirmations and visualization. And so I believe that they were, because of those practices, a little bit more open and receptive. I had to make sure they understood the nexus mm-hmm. between these powerful practices that they use in operations and how they also impacted judgment and implicit bias and all of those things that we focus on in the DEI space.
Yeah, that's wonderful. And it's tricky, you know, like, as you know, I don't know if you could say we're post-pandemic, whatever place we're in with the pandemic. Right. And of course, this is being recorded at an earlier time than it will be played. So there's even more uncertainty. But, you know, mental health is taking a hit in general. And you're doing a lot of work with first responders. And something that I've been drawn to for years and years now has been what we call, I think, in a misnomer, really, we call caregivers. You know, it's like people on the front lines of suffering, whether it's in their families or professionally, who are dealing with the trauma of others and yet feeling quite traumatized themselves. And so it's a very unusual arena because it's not often appreciated the toll it takes.
Most definitely. And I think that, you know, the trauma, particularly, you know, the vicarious trauma mm-hmm. that is impacted, most definitely that comes up a lot in the first responder space, as well as those who are just dealing with life and all of its various challenges in general, particularly mm-hmm. post George Floyd and in the pandemic, I think that radical self-care is just a requirement for all of us. And I'm not a healthcare specialist per se, but we have, and particularly in the DEI office, have always worked really closely with counseling services units at both FDNY and PBS. And with first responders, you definitely see the cynicism because they have to learn to wear the world as a loose garment. But you also see a lot of incredible faith and support for one another. I experienced there really strong bonds of authentic trust mm-hmm. and supportive relationships than you see in other environments because their lives are constantly at stake. And so one of the other things that I often have to address and think about in the DEI space is the radical self-care that's required for us. And I think it's not just one group. I think it's all of us who carry the trauma of our ancestors. Mm-hmm. And I think we carry the baggage of both those tortured and the torturers, mm-hmm. those who have been enslaved and the enslavers, and so on. And so one of the things that I'm grateful that I was able to learn before my mother passed away this year is that one of my ancestors, one of our uncles, great uncles, was lynched. And as a world and a country and a community, we carry this harm in our bones. And so the challenge in the DEI space and just in general is to build the capacity to heal and to do the work that's necessary for healing and find that common ground and build upon it mm-hmm. a new world of love and of patience and of grace.
And it's very encouraging that you're saying you're finding people doing just that.
Yes, yes, most definitely. And it takes a while, I think, for us to realize what's necessary mm-hmm. and to bring our whole selves to what needs to be done in a way that allows us to do so without fear. And that's really, I think, the challenge, the daily challenge that we're confronted with. And once again, it's those circles or opportunities to relate to each other in a way that is authentic and allows us to see each other and to hear each other, to listen in a new way that is so incredibly important in this space.
One of the things that I saw working with caregivers, which began with domestic violence shelter workers, was an incredible sense of isolation. And so community, as perhaps the most powerful healing agent, was also a little remote, you know, like even though people were in the same line of work, it felt like they couldn't really talk about what they were experiencing. It was like, even though they were all doing the same kind of things, although in different shelters, it was not only for the sake of confidentiality, but it was both the appearance that they felt they had to uphold, which was somebody who gave more than they got, you know, that they were strong, they were invincible, they were there to help others, they were there to save others. And that was a part of it. And part of it was that the stories were just so painful, you know, and often evoked their own previous trauma or unhappiness or something. And so people were not in the habit of actually creating community in a funny way.
Yeah, it's one of the things that I'm really grateful for is that I learned circle keeping in large part with an organization called Hidden Water. And its focus is on the sexual abuse that have been suffered by children. And so it taught me to hold space and to listen and to be a healing influence for some of the most horrendous experiences. And just to have the capacity and the willingness and the commitment to be an energy of love. And that's one of the things I love about, you know, the work that you do, Sharon, in loving kindness. And I worked at the Human Rights Commission in New York before I went to the fire department. And one of the things that I was grateful to realize is that the energy that I brought just by having a practice of loving kindness meditation was so incredibly important. And so it was the presence that I brought and the witness that was also provided an energy of healing and restoration. And I remember a young man coming into the office, and at that time, it didn't matter whether or not you had an appointment. You could just walk in off the street with a complaint. And he was a member of the LGBT community, and he was just shaking all over. And I just calmly said to him, "Breathe. Let's just breathe." Mm. And I realized that the merits of those cases didn't matter, but it was being heard. Mm-hmm. That was so incredibly important. And so I often tell our circle keepers and others in the DEI space, a lot of the preparation for the work that we do comes long before we enter the room. And it's centering ourselves in that compassion and in that energy of love, and realizing that sometimes we can walk into a space and just be a presence and a witness with that energy of love. And it's sending out that loving energy when you pass someone, or when you see someone, or when you hear about something that is also important in this sort of ministry of love that we call DEI.
That's a lovely term for it, the Ministry of Love, DEI.
Yeah, that's what it is for me. And I think that we are hesitant about calling it love because, you know, it sits in the business world. But essentially, that is what it is. It is in embracing everyone and seeing everyone and uplifting everyone despite differences. Mm-hmm.
Well, I think it's so crucial, you know, because it's like the path we think we're going to take to healing is often, for some of us, it's not actually a path to healing. And something I've talked about on this podcast a lot with various guests is have some moves, we think that shame is really the root. And yet, you know, the worse we feel about ourselves, the kind of less energy we tend to have to try to make change. We're just so demoralized and we feel hopeless. And I've heard psychologists more currently say things like, this one said, the brain filled with shame cannot learn. Mm. Of course, our goal is learning. It's behavior change. It's being a different person, which we are capable of being. And so not just falling into that sort of, you know, pit of self-hatred as a path, thinking it's going to work. It takes a very particular kind of understanding.
And just, you know, what you just explained was a real light bulb that went off for me when I first started studying with Elizabeth Clements around circle keeping and she has an organization called Planning Change, which teaches circle keeping. And the one of the most valuable lessons that I learned was the importance of how shame impacts us. And in the DEI space, there often is a tendency to blame and shame and guilt. And that's one of the reasons I start off with a practice of teaching emotional intelligence through circle. And lifting up the importance of having compassion for everyone, because you just cannot do the work that needs to be done without that.
I think that's really great. And the people often ask me about the extent to which I imagine people experience vicarious trauma. For example, this recent question came in, do journalists get it? What do I think? So I'm going to pass it on to you.
Yeah, I mean, I think that anyone has the potential to have vicarious trauma if they're serving in such a way that there's just the repetition of stories and harm and most certainly. And, you know, once again, I think that the radical self-care is so necessary for all of us in the various ways that trauma may show up in our lives. And oftentimes I think we're not even conscious of it, but we have to do the work and we have to have the practices that center us in the power and presence of love and compassion for one another.
Wonderful. Let's do it. That's really great, because here you are, you know, you're in a media world now, and I've certainly met journalists, not only those who've gone to war, but definitely those who've gone to war, who are really suffering a lot and struggling with the complexity, you know, of views and knowledge and just the hurt that we can inflict on ourselves and on one another. And so I can't really think of an arena of life where it doesn't figure somewhere.
Yeah, and you mentioned the media world, and it's interesting how times have changed. And many of us just in our daily lives become part of the media of social media and that impact, which is not even governed by, you know, the same rules as other types of more established media. And so, you know, there's just this constant vigilance that we have to have in terms of staying centered and practicing what we call in the more traditional space, practicing the presence of spirit. Mm-hmm. And I, you know, I guess it doesn't really matter what your theology is. As Thich Nhat Hanh said, that there are some Buddhists who are more Christian than Christian and some Christians who are more Buddhist than Buddhist. Mm-hmm. It is practicing the presence of love.
Mm-hmm. That's beautiful. So before we finish, I'm wondering if you could lead us in a guided practice of some kind to bring the conversation to a close.
Thank you so much. I'd be honored to do so. And so I just like to invite the listeners, if it's available to you, just to close your eyes. Just center on the presence and power just of the breath. Just breathe into that energy of love and light. Just regardless of the sounds that are going on around you. And just connect with that energy of breath and the power and presence of love that continues to give birth to us, that gave birth to us from the beginning of time. And just feel that love as though it embraces your entire being, your body, every cell and every molecule of who you are, everything that expresses in, as, and through you, filling every muscle and every organ. And in the energy and awareness of this love and how it breathes us, let's just center on a time before religion, before the expression of all that we are today. And just see ourselves pulsating from the first being or beings that ever were, from our mothers, 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 from our fathers, 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 fathers. Thousands of years ago, and realize that the breath of our four beings was the energy of love, and feel the strength and the compassion. The connection with that energy of love. Love is as a divine connection to all our relations that ever were. Love connecting the plants, the sun, the grass, every color, every reflection, every direction, and just feel the expanse of that love in which you live and move and have your being. That freedom, that liberty of everything and everyone. And also nothing and no one and nowhere. In this connection, just resonate, if you can, just with love. And feel it breathing through you as a single breath. And then another. And another. And another. And feeling that connection between each and every being. Whoever was or ever will be. And realizing this connection, this oneness, is something that we all share. From our mothers, 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 mothers. And our fathers, 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 bringing us to this moment and to this breath and to this energy and this awareness. And so it is. So let it be. Whenever you're ready, you can flutter open your eyes if they were closed, and return again to the present moment. Thank you.
Well, thank you so much for the beautiful meditation and for joining me today. To learn more about Cecilia's work, you can visit www.mindfulnessgroup.blog. It's www.mindfulnessgroup.blog, B-L-O-G. Or check out her many book offerings. Big thanks to everyone who's listening. This has been the Metta Hour podcast from the Be Here Now Network. May you be safe, be happy, be healthy, and may you live with ease.
Hey folks, thanks for listening. To learn more about Sharon and her ongoing teaching schedule, as well as online courses and a free guided meditation, check out her website at sharonsalzberg.com.